Venerable Chodron is still traveling until the 9th. She'll be back at the Abbey on the 9th. And so tonight we'll continue our pursuits in the chapter on basic Buddhist ontology. So let's start by cultivating a motivation for our time together tonight. Earlier today I was listening to a BBC that Venerable recorded in 2010. And she was asking, why are we here at the Abbey? And as she continued, she said, we're here to develop a kind heart. Not only a kind heart, but also compassion, ethical conduct, patience, forgiveness, service to others. And these are valued by people of all different faiths. And also those with no faith would value these. A kind heart is something that we all aspire for and something that we have to work at developing. But Buddhism is also distinguished by the development of wisdom. Wisdom which pacifies suffering by directly opposing its root cause, self-grasping ignorance. The ignorance that misperceives the sense of I or self in our own continuum to be independent, inherent, existing from its own side. And so to accomplish an enlightened mind, we need to bring together both method and wisdom in our mind. Without utilizing knowledge and wisdom, we can't reach the depths of the Buddhist doctrine. So let's generate our good hearts for our study and practice of reasoning and debate tonight, and combine that with wisdom, so that our efforts actually become a cause for full awakening, so that we can develop more of our full potential, actually to its utmost extent, so that we can be of greater and greater benefit to all beings. In response to a question on Tuesday, Jeffrey Hopkins paraphrased Lama Tsongkhapa as saying that the difference between bodhisattvas and hearers and solitary realizers is that hearer and solitary realizers don't have a mind broadened by the extensive reasoning with respect to emptiness. Hearers and solitary realizers use only one or two reasonings with respect to emptiness, but bodhisattvas have a mind that is broadened by manifold reasonings with respect to emptiness. He said it becomes important for those interested in Dan Perdue said it becomes important for those interested in the great vehicle path to broaden their minds, beginning with even studying one chapter in Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise, each of which has several reasonings, and to broaden the mind with emptiness. And so this highlights the importance of reasoning in our tradition. It's interesting that the philosophical training in Tibetan monasteries begins with instruction in basic logic, learning the way of reasoning, which includes the major points of terminology and classifications like we're learning now. The preliminary study of logic is compared to the study of the alphabet and grammar in primary school, which allows one to understand greater things later. So we're building a foundation with our studies. There's a nice quote of Geshe Rabtan. It comes from his biography, where he said, logic is studied to train the mind in subtle reasoning, enabling later appreciation of the great scriptures. After developing one's intelligence and discriminatory powers in this way, the monastic is able to apply as many as 20 logical arguments to just one point of teaching. Like monkeys that can run freely in and out through a dense forest, our minds must be very supple before we can comprehend the depth of the concepts presented in the great scriptures. If our minds are rigid like the antlers of a deer, we will never be able to reach the depths. In my own experience in the study program at Chenrezig Institute, we studied topics like mind and awareness, tenets, paths and grounds, logic and reasoning, and several others before we ever got to studying Lamrim Chimmo, the great Lamrim text by Lama Tsongkhapa. And I was kind of surprised by this because I think many of us might have the conception that Lam Rim is easier. But actually what I found in my experience is that I was so happy to have some of the philosophical studies under my belt, because when we read through Lama Tsongkhapa's Lam Rim Chimo, it's very helpful to know something about tenets and something about the different kinds of mind and even things about the paths and grounds. And so they say that Lam Rim is actually like a condensation or a distillation of all the great scriptures. And so we have to have some knowledge built up to really be able to understand the Lam Rim in its full depth, in its full extent. So these teachings that we're going through now are going to be very valuable to us. It may seem, what would be the adjective? You supplied the adjective. Might be a little tedious, or maybe for some boring, or for some challenging. But I think as we go along, what we'll see is that our minds actually do start to become more supple, more sharp, geared towards looking at things in a different way. In our education system, we're trained to be polite and to raise our hand before we answer a question. It's very different in the monasteries. It's a very raucous experience in a class. The teacher will ask a question, and everyone just answers all at the same time. They're not afraid of being wrong. They probably have a different relationship with pride than we do. And so that's one of the hurdles that we have to get over, is our fear of being wrong, answering a question that might be wrong. Nobody wants to look like a fool, including me. But debate really is a system for helping each other to learn. I've heard many times that they say of the monastic studies that 25% of the knowledge comes from the teacher and 75% comes from the students debating and talking with each other about the material. So I think it's good to review that from time to time and to really keep that in mind, that we're here to help each other in our studies. We're not competing. We're not, it's really a group process. Last week, we talked about the seven terms equivalent with existent. And so for those of you who are new to this topic, this might sound a bit like gobbledygook or French or Greek or something. You're welcome to take a look at the text that we've been using and see if it might be a benefit to you as well. So last week I brought in some discussion about different consciousnesses. We were talking about direct perceivers and direct reliable cognizers, inferential reliable cognizers. And I also asked some questions about how certain points are held in different tenet schools. For example, we talked about the two lower tenet schools, Sutra School and Great Exposition School. They assert the consciousness of a Buddha is all-knowing, not omniscient, whereas the two higher schools have a different understanding about the capacities of a Buddha. I was doing this not to confuse anyone, and certainly not to impress anyone, but I was doing it for two reasons. It's difficult to discuss any of the philosophical subjects without referring to information in other areas. No matter where you start at the beginning, there's always information you should have under your belt. So that's a little bit challenging. For example, we're studying collected topics, but which is typically taught as the first philosophical subject. But notice how many references there are to different kinds of minds and to some of the tenet assertions of the Sutra School. And so it's a process of building up our knowledge base. Secondly, this subject is presented from the point of view of the Sutra School following reasoning. And so we may need to bring in some of our knowledge that we gained when we studied tenets. And so those of you who haven't studied tenets, maybe you'd like to take a look at Precious Garland of Tenets in the book Cutting Through Appearances. Just read the Sutra School section and that can help to, again, provide some further understanding. It's good, in fact, to bring in information from our previous studies because this reinforces our understanding and it also improves our memory of those subjects. I know for myself, when I first started studying philosophy, it was overwhelming. There was just such a whirlwind of information. But slowly, slowly over time, you know, with some repetition, a lot of repetition actually, things start to stick, and I'm sure you've noticed that in your own studies. especially those of you who have been here a while. So tonight, let's just warm up with a little bit of debate before we go back to our text. How many divisions of the selfless are there? Two. Sing it out. The two divisions of selfless cannot be posited. What do you say to that? It follows the two divisions of the selfless can be posited. Venerable Dhamcha, posit those two divisions, please.
The two divisions are existence and non-existence.
So it follows that the two divisions of the selfless are existence and non-existence.
I accept.
Good. So how do these two compare, selfless and existent?
Mutually inclusive.
Mutually inclusive. Okay, so everything that's an existent is selfless, and everything that's selfless is an existent. No. Okay. You want to try again? Okay. 3P. Okay. Please posit something that's both and a selfless and existent.
Something that is both selfless and existent is that whiteboard.
That whiteboard. That beautiful new whiteboard. Yay. Okay, and can you posit something that's selfless that is not existent?
Yes, the turtle's mustache.
A turtle's mustache. Yeah, it's a non-existent, right? It's selfless. Even non-existent things are considered selfless, but it's not an existent. Okay, can you posit something that is existent that is not selfless?
No.
No, so that's the possibility that doesn't exist. There is nothing that is existent that is also not selfless. Or we could say whatever is existent is selfless, whatever is selfless is not necessarily existent.
Would that be, do we say that there's three possibilities with nothing that's...
Nothing that is neither.
Neither.
Mm-hmm. So there's nothing that's neither because?
There's nothing that's neither because that encapsulates all existence and non-existence.
That meaning
selfless.
Selfless encompasses or encapsulates everything that is existent, non-existent. Yeah. Great, thank you. Okay. The definition of existent can't be posited. Just warming up here.
Why?
That's Southern for why. Huh? Okay. So it follows that the definition of existent can be posited. Venerable Losong.
I accept.
Posit that definition, please.
The definition of an existent is that which is observed by a reliable cognizer.
So it follows that the definition of existent is that which is observed by a reliable cognizer.
I accept.
Good. Okay. So how do these two compare? Existent and that which is observed by a reliable cognizer. Mutually inclusive. Okay. That's right. And how many equivalent terms are stated in our text for existent? 8, including existent. Mm-hmm. Or we could say 7.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Those 7 can't be posited. No one dares to answer. How many of you... Thank you. Oh, so it follows those 7 equivalent terms for existent in our text can be posited.
I accept.
Okay, before I ask you to posit those, how many can actually posit all 8 definitions? Come on, don't be shy.
I look at my notes.
I didn't say not looking at the notes. Okay, good. All right, posit those definitions. Check him, okay?
I already did existent.
Yes, okay. You don't have to do it again.
So the next one is the definition of an established base is that which is established by a reliable cognizer. And the definition of a object of comprehension is that which is realized by a valid cognition.
Reliable cognizer.
Reliable cognizer. Yes. The definition of an object is that which is known by an awareness. Mm-hmm. The definition of an object of knowledge is that which is suitable as an object of awareness. The definition of a hidden phenomena is an object which is realized in a hidden manner by a thought consciousness apprehending it. The definition of a object of comprehension of an omniscient consciousness is an object that is realized by an omniscient consciousness. And the definition of a phenomena is that which holds its own entity.
Whoa, well done.
Is that all of it?
Okay, good job. All right.
We went over them at dinner.
Good. With who? Venerable Pindi. So you could repeat them back to him, couldn't you? And Venerable Tarpa. Okay. Good. So we'll just call that good. I'm not going to repeat them again. How did the two compare, existent and established base? All together. Excellent. How do these two compare? That which is observed by a reliable cognizer and that which is realized by a reliable cognizer. Mutually inclusive. Very good. Okay, so something that didn't come up when we first learned about things being mutually inclusive is the criteria. We didn't look at the criteria for something being mutually inclusive. I don't remember this coming up. So there are two criteria, and it's just helpful to know because you'll read this in the debate text. The first criteria is that we're comparing two things, right? So they have to be different, at least different in name, but the objects included within each are the same. So they share a common locus. That's the first one. The second one is that they share the eight doors of pervasion. Have you heard that before? Okay. So if two things are mutually inclusive, they will share eight doors of pervasion. So let's look at existent and established base. We said that they're mutually inclusive. And so the first four have to do with whatever is something is the other. And then the second set of four have to do if one exists, the other exists. So it goes like this. Whatever is an existent is necessarily an established base. Whatever is an established base is necessarily an existent. And the opposite of that. Whatever is not an existent is not an established base. And whatever is not an established base is not an existent. Then the second set of four. If an existent exists, an established base exists. If an established base exists, an existent exists. If an existent does not exist, an established base does not exist. And if an established base does not exist, an existent does not exist. So this is just important to keep in mind, in the back of your mind. This is true of any two things that are mutually inclusive. And it's, as we've seen in what we've just been through, definitions and their definiendum are mutually inclusive. So they share the eight doors of pervasion. But even equivalent terms for the same thing will share these eight doors of pervasion. Okay, so that's just a little aside. Last week, a doubt came up when we were learning about hidden phenomena. So I did a little more research on the Sutra School's presentation about hidden phenomena. And it's actually quite an extensive subject, but I'm just going to highlight the points that we need to understand. So if we look at a description of these two terms, these are not the definitions, but if we look at a description of what these terms are or include, so we're looking at hidden phenomena and manifest phenomena. Manifest phenomena is that which is suitable to appear to a direct perceiver. This is something very unique to the Sutra School. And as we'll see, or as we learned in Precious Garland of Tenets, that manifest phenomena is mutually inclusive with functioning thing, impermanent phenomena, compounded phenomena, specifically characterized phenomena, ultimate truth. It's a very specific presentation. And so this is unique to the Sutra School, and it's something that we'll be learning as we go through collected topics. So manifest phenomena is that which is suitable to appear to a direct perceiver. So a direct perceiver is necessarily non-conceptual, a non-conceptual knower, and a non-mistaken knower. The characteristic of hidden phenomena is that which can appear to a thought consciousness. That which can appear to a thought consciousness. So permanent phenomena, according to the Sutra school, must appear to a thought consciousness. That tenet school says that permanent phenomena cannot appear to a direct receiver. So all permanent phenomena must be known by a thought consciousness or a conceptual consciousness.
Tenet school says that impermanent?
Permanent phenomena must appear to thought consciousness.
But you said that impermanent, it does not appear?
No, it doesn't appear to a direct receiver. Yeah. But impermanent phenomena can also appear to a thought consciousness. Right? And last week we talked about this. Like, for instance, we can have a direct perception, an eye consciousness, primary eye consciousness, seeing the color and shape of the thermos. And then if we close our eyes, we can generate a conceptual consciousness or a thought consciousness about some of the general characteristics of the thermos. So on one hand, we can know this with our sense consciousnesses. We can also know it with our thought consciousness. Okay, so can you see how hidden phenomena is going to include, hidden phenomena is going to include both permanent phenomena and impermanent phenomena. But manifest phenomena is only going to include impermanent phenomena that can be known with sense consciousnesses, direct perceptions. Does that make sense? All right, so manifest phenomena only includes impermanent phenomena. Hidden phenomena, as we know, it's mutually inclusive with existence, so it's going to include permanent and impermanent phenomena. So which is going to be the bigger circle? Hidden phenomena. It's going to pervade.
The manifest phenomena, just because it's...
Yeah, and it will be coming up in our text a little bit later. Manifest phenomena is that which is suitable to appear to a direct perceiver. In other words, if it's going to appear to any consciousness, it will appear to a direct perceiver of one kind or another.
The direct perceiver was a non-mistaken...
Non-conceptual, non-mistaken knower. Okay, so that might be a little confusing right now, but hang in there. The main point of this is to see, it's one of the unique presentations of the Sutra school, that hidden phenomena pervade manifest phenomena for the Sutra school. So if we were to draw that out, it'd be three possibilities, right? Because we'd find manifest phenomena, which is synonymous or equivalent with impermanent phenomena, in the larger circle of hidden phenomena, which is equivalent with existent. So we're looking at possibilities of how two things relate to each other. One is a subset of the other. And when we have something that is a subset of the other, we say there are three possibilities. If we're comparing two things, X and Y, they're either going to be mutually inclusive, meaning they overlap, so we call that MI, or they're going to be mutually exclusive, like hot and cold, or they can be three possibilities, meaning one is a subset of the other, or they can be four possibilities. There's some overlap, but there are definitely things that are one, not the other, and the other, not the one, and then often there's something that's neither as well. So this is a very good tool for us to really understand what are the limits of a particular phenomenon.
I think what makes this clear to me is to understand that in this system, permanent phenomena are not seen by direct perceivers. They're only things that you think up, that appear to thought. And when I separate it that way, but I get lost in the words unless I start with something that is familiar to me, like impermanent phenomena and permanent phenomena are two words that were familiar.
Yes.
And so if I start with that and I just think about it in those terms,
okay,
then I do better.
So when we're comparing two things, it's often a good trick to just make a note out to the side. What does this include? What are things that I already know that are included in this that will help me to do this comparison? So hidden phenomena includes impermanent and permanent phenomena. And manifest phenomena is only includes impermanent phenomena for this school.
So hidden phenomena includes all existence.
What's that?
Hidden phenomena includes all existence.
Yes. Yes. Existence or established basis actually is what's usually divided, and we're going to get into that tonight. Usually divided into permanent and impermanent phenomena, functioning thing and permanent phenomena.
Okay, so we begin by saying if we don't know, well, we don't want to just guess randomly. We'll say, well, is there something that's both a hidden phenomena and a manifest phenomena? And there is, isn't there? What? Give me an example. Emptiness. Okay, emptiness. Why do you say emptiness? Emptiness is a hidden phenomenon and a manifest phenomenon. It has to be something that's impermanent because we find impermanent in both.
Yeah.
Okay, so give me another attempt. Speaker, the black speaker. Okay, something that is one but not two. So what is a hidden phenomenon that is not a manifest phenomenon?
How is a speaker hidden?
No, we're looking for something that is both. It would be included within hidden phenomena and also included within manifest phenomena.
I'm confused of the definition of hidden phenomena. I think hidden, it can't be perceived except by a thought.
Yes, but can't you call anything to mind by your conceptual consciousness? You can call to mind, if I say emptiness, something will appear to your mind, right? It may not be very clear. I don't know. Maybe it is very clear for you. It's not for me. But if I say any permanent thing, you can call up an image of that. And if I say the name of an impermanent thing, like the speaker, something will appear to your mind. So
I wouldn't call that hidden, though. It's there. It's inside my mind.
It's hidden. So hidden process.
We have to understand. Well, let's think about. Okay, let's think about the definition. An object that is realized in a hidden manner. Why is it hidden for the Sutra School? Does anybody know?
Because it's using a generic image.
Because they get at it by using a generic image. Yeah. So this is one of their basic tenets, that they really separate out phenomena by the kind of mind that knows it. They really prize direct perceivers because they, as Venerable Tarpa was saying last week, they know, direct perceiver knows the object fully. It knows all the different unique characteristics and features, where a generic image, thinking about it conceptually, we only get a few of the characteristics that come to mind, not all of them. Okay? That's a good question.
Okay, something that is a hidden phenomenon that is not a manifest phenomenon. What would be an example? Emptiness. Good. Emptiness. And emptiness is a hidden phenomenon and not a manifest phenomenon because it's permanent. It's a permanent phenomenon. Is there something that is a manifest phenomena that's in that category? Like, I remember Bill McGee used to say, think about this as a 64-gallon drum. Is that the number?
55.
This is a, 55-gallon drum, and this is another 55-gallon drum, this hidden phenomena. So what's inside that? All the hidden phenomena are inside that. So impermanent things or instances of impermanent phenomena and instances of permanent phenomena. In this 55-gallon drum, there's only impermanent phenomena. So we're looking to see, is there something in this drum that's also in that drum? Does that help? Well, it's half empty, okay? It doesn't have to be full. Okay, is there something that is a manifest phenomenon that's not a hidden phenomenon?
No.
There's not, is there? Because every impermanent phenomena is also included within hidden phenomena, the category. Hidden phenomena. Okay, so there's nothing. And then is there something that is neither a manifest or hidden phenomenon? In this situation, there's not, because impermanent and permanent cover all existent things, objective knowledge.
Rabbit's horn.
Thank you. Yes, we can put a non-existent there. Thank you.
Okay, so horns of a rabbit. Thanks, I didn't see that.
Impermanent phenomena can be got at either through direct perception or through a generic image. And then permanent phenomena can only be gotten at through a generic image.
According to the Sutra School. And if you think about it, it doesn't really make a lot of sense because how do you get at a conceptual consciousness? If I was thinking about a vase, and I actually will know vase by thinking about a generic image of vase. So I can get at the object, it's just I don't get at the object fully. With a direct perceiver, I can see the object.
But it's just, I was saying that because it makes the point that the impermanent phenomena can be either.
Uh-huh.
But a permanent phenomena has to be gotten at by a generic image.
Yeah.
So the definition of hidden phenomena, I think Venerable Sempke was saying a moment ago, she was trying to add, has to be gotten at by, it's not an object that has to be gotten at. It's an object realized in a hidden manner by a thought consciousness apprehending it. But the object may or may not be something that could be gotten at in another way.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
What do you mean by that? You mean you could be gotten at by your eye consciousness?
Yeah, depending on whether or not it's an impermanent or a permanent phenomena, a hidden phenomena could be a manifest phenomena also. Like the book is a manifest phenomena, but it can also be a hidden phenomena if I'm just remembering it. It could be either, right, where the permanent can only be the one.
Right, different consciousness know.
Yeah. But the permanent phenomena can only be the one.
Yeah, so it comes down to what is the consciousness that's realizing it instead of the object. So we'll contrast this to the consequent school as we go along further down the track. But just know this is a unique presentation of the Sutra School. This is why, some of you, this will ring a bell. This is why they say, from the Sutra School point of view, you cannot realize selflessness directly. You have to realize it through seeing the aggregates, the body and the mind, as lacking or, you know, with an absence of a self. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
I'm still a bit stuck on this.
Okay. All right, good. Let's keep going so it's clear.
Okay. So because of the definition that it's realized in a hidden manner by a thought consciousness,
yes,
not a direct perceiver.
Right.
So how can it be in the category including impermanent, since it's a thought consciousness and not a direct perceiver?
Because impermanent phenomena can be realized by a thought consciousness, it can also be realized by a direct perceiver. You can see an impermanent phenomena with, say, your eyes, and you can also think about it. So it can be known in two different ways. So in that regard, it can fit in both of those categories. Mm-hmm.
And also that the consciousness is impermanent, but the object can be permanent.
I thought that was what she was getting at.
But with the thought consciousness, it's still, you're just remembering it. You know, it's not as clear as a direct perceiver.
Right. It's not. But, okay. So, this might complicate issues. You know, when we talked about an eye consciousness seeing a vase, the appearing object is vase. That's the actual object that's appearing to the mind. And what that mind knows, the apprehended object or the engaged object, is a vase. A thought consciousness apprehending a vase, the appearing object is now a generic image of a vase. But what is that mind knowing? What is the engaged object, the apprehended object? It's still a vase. You can know vase by thinking about a vase. So in both ways, both of those consciousnesses can actually get at that object. It's just that they get at that object, one gets at that object fully, directly, without the medium of a generic image. The other gets at it. You know, we know vase when we think about it. We don't know it like when we're looking at it with our eyes. But both ways will help us to understand the engaged object. That's what the mind understands. In both situations, eye consciousness
and thought consciousness, the mind understands vase. That's not a vase, but you know what I'm pointing to. Thermos. Does that help? Okay. Good. Yeah. Some of these things like appearing objects, engage objects, we have to think about those quite a while for those to really start to settle.
Yeah. This is just to make sure I'm thinking. As far as the consequence school, however, just so I know it's in my brain,
okay.
Is generic images are permanent phenomena.
Yeah. Well, this is what
this is the debate. This is a debate, right?
Actually, that's what debate book says. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That might be where my confusion is.
Okay. So why is a generic image considered permanent? It's because to get at an object, what the mind is actually doing is eliminating everything that is not that object, and that's how we and scientists have proven this that that's how our mind operates. Mm-hmm. So to know a conceptual image, a generic image, or a mental image of the thermos. My mind is eliminating everything it knows that is non-thermos. Yeah.
But in the sutra school, a generic image is permanent.
Yeah. I think she was just asking because when I brought this up last week, Venerable had a doubt about it, whether generic images are permanent or not.
Yeah.
That's a subtle debate that.
Yeah. As in, you were saying, in the consequence school, generic images are permanent. Mm-hmm. But likewise, in the sutra school, generic images are permanent.
Yeah. In general, we can say generic images for everyone, they are permanent phenomena.
You're getting a permanent generic image of an impermanent phenomenon.
Yeah.
Right? That's what's going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because it's an absence. Just like emptiness is a lack of something, right? It's a lack of a particular type of self. That's, in a similar way, a generic image is a lack of everything that is the thing you're thinking about. And that's how you know the thing. Sure.
You're talking about objects, and you're talking about permanent and impermanent.
Yes.
And so now you are talking about, say, for example, you are talking about a clay, a vase made out of clay.
Uh-huh.
So here is an object. Mass, that is impermanent.
Yes.
You can break
that. Uh-huh.
But what is permanent there is the clay.
No. The clay is not permanent. If we're talking about a manifest object, it's impermanent. It's changing moment to moment. We're going to get into this in just a minute. We're going to start reading about impermanent phenomena and permanent phenomena.
Okay.
So when we use our eye consciousness to see the clay vase, what we're seeing is the shape and the color and, you know, all the contents of the clay. And all of that is changing moment to moment, both in a coarse way and in a very subtle way. Moment to moment, there's no staticness to that vase, right? We know this from science. Everything is changing moment to moment. Like, you're not the same person that came into this room. You've changed many, many ways just from breathing in and out.
Sure.
Yeah, same thing with the vase. But when we have a conceptual consciousness that's thinking about vase, there's no vase there. There's a generic image or a picture, a mental picture of what a vase is. And how the mind actually knows that vase.
We have seen it.
Well, we have seen it in the past, but right now we're not seeing it. But what our mind is doing, I think of it this way, it's going through all the files in my mind of things it knows, and it's saying it's not that, and it's not that, and it's not that. And finally, it arrives at what it is by knowing what it's not.
Okay.
That's how it's described in the Buddhist literature.
In Sanskrit, there is a word called niti. So you are deleting, this is not, this is not, this is not. Finally, your atma or the soul is the real one.
Well, that's debatable, isn't it? Or at least we'd have a good debate about that. Actually, in this school of thought, from the Buddhist point of view, we're trying to look for how does the self exist, and what we find is something different. We find that there is no permanent, unitary, independent self that's there. There's a constantly changing body and mind, and independence upon that constantly changing body and mind, we impute self, or I, or Seppel. But this school doesn't assert anything similar to a soul. It's the mind, the very subtle mind that goes from life to life carrying karmic seeds. So, yeah. And right now we're just in the part of the text that's helping us to look at the ontological descriptions of what exists for this, you know, this Buddhist presentation. Okay. Let's we left off on page 148, I think. So let's have a look at the text.
It's a phrase?
Yes. Seven divisions of existence on the top of page 148. So it says, seven divisions of existence. Existence are divided into seven main pairs that together serve to illustrate the Buddhist understanding of phenomena. So that's saying that if we took this one pie called phenomena, we could divide it in seven different ways. We could divide it in terms of impermanent phenomena and permanent phenomena, what we've just been discussing. We could divide it in terms of functioning things and phenomena that are non-things, products and non-product phenomena, non-produced phenomena, composed phenomena and uncomposed phenomena, ultimate truths and conventional truths. Now, we have to put on our sutra hat really tightly because your consequence hat will pop right up and it will confuse you. Because in the consequence school, we say only emptiness is ultimate truths. But here, ultimate truth is all impermanent phenomena. It's like night and day. But this is how they present it. So for now, we have to put on our sutra hat, okay? Ultimate truths and conventional truths. Specifically characterized phenomena and generally characterized phenomena. And what we'll see, the next 20 pages are describing these different pairs and what's included. And what we'll find is that specifically characterized phenomena are talking about impermanent phenomena and how they're known. All of their specific characteristics are known by a direct perceiver. Whereas the generally characterized phenomena... Yeah. I said known. Even awareness to which an object appears but is not ascertained knows an object, it just doesn't ascertain it. Doesn't realize it, but it does... it appears to that mind. I take your point. So generally characterized phenomena include permanent phenomena. So when it's talking about the conceptual consciousness again, how the conceptual consciousness just takes the general characteristics of something to mind when we're thinking about it through the medium of a generic image. Okay, it doesn't have all the characteristics that it would if we were using a sense consciousness or a direct perceiver of some kind. And then the last one is hidden phenomena and manifest phenomena. So we'll get to that. We'll talk about that more when we come to that. All right, so divisions of existence into impermanent phenomena and permanent phenomena. The most important division of existence is into impermanent phenomena. Anicca, is that the... No, that's not the term you were using.
Neti,
okay. Okay. Yeah, all right. The most important division of existence is into impermanent phenomena and permanent phenomena. This is traditionally presented as a division of established bases into permanent phenomena and functioning things. However, here, impermanent phenomena is paired with permanent phenomena because it is easier to grasp initially. In other words, Westerners would say, what are you talking about? What's a functioning thing? So they're just making it easy for us. It's better to explain impermanent phenomena first because we are manifestly surrounded by them. All right, so impermanent phenomena. In trying to understand the nature of existence, the sensible place to begin is with what is all around us and inside of us as well. The single most important clear insight we can develop from the study of Buddhist thought is a pervasive awareness of impermanence. Why is that the case? That's a question. Why is that the case that the single most important clear insight we can develop from the study of Buddhist thought is a pervasive awareness of impermanence? Because we'll lighten our grasp to everything and have less suffering. Right. And what else? It cuts craving. It's the antidote, one of the antidotes to attachment, isn't it? What else?
Makes you think about death.
Makes you think about death. Death and impermanence go together, don't they? Right. And then what else? Helps you to realize emptiness, right? And dependent arising, yep. Helps us to understand the first level of dependent arising. We won't waste our precious human rebirth. It paves the way for understanding emptiness and helps us to refute a permanent, unitary, independent self, as well as grasping at permanence in general. Okay, the definition of an impermanent phenomena. An impermanent phenomena is an existent. It is a phenomena. It is impermanent because it is changing moment by moment. Thus, an impermanent phenomena is defined as a momentary phenomena. The definiendum and the definition are of similar length, aren't they? Okay, so this means that it exists for just a moment. The things around us, the book, your body, your room, and so on, appear to be stable and abiding. You know, you walk back into the room a few minutes later wondering, where did I put my phone? We don't say that here, but where did I put my keys? Where did I put my glasses? Where did I put my robe? Where did I put my shoes? Which door did I leave my shoes at? Yeah, okay. Where did I put my phone? And then there it is. Of course, it appears to be the same phone you put down a few minutes ago, but the way the Buddhists think of it, the phone in this moment is the result, the later effect of the same type, the descendant of the one you left in the room a few minutes ago. So that's what I was just saying. We all know that in time, the paint fades in the sunlight, the spine of the book gets broken, and you get lines around your eyes and your hair grays. But we usually don't think too much about these things. That's the problem, right? Buddhists generally agree that every one of these things that are produced from causes and conditions, such as our body, our room, our phone, our book, and so on, arise, abide, disintegrate, and arise again over and over 360 times a moment. According to one Buddhist tenet system, the rate is 60 times every moment. Actually, I've heard 64 in the amount of, but you know, it's a lot. Let's put it that way. But the predominant opinion is 360 times every moment. A moment is the time it takes for a person to blink or snap the fingers. Actually, in the text, it says for a young person to snap their fingers. Things like that are not stable. They last only for a moment, usually to be created again in the next moment. In any given moment, the thing before you serves as the cause of itself in the next moment. The reality of impermanence is a constant and driving consideration at all levels of Buddhist practice. Buddhists speak of impermanence in two main ways, as coarse impermanence and as subtle impermanence. Coarse impermanence is easy to see, for example, when someone passes away, or a building falls down, or a chair breaks, or a flower wilts and dies. It's obvious to our senses. We don't need to use reasoning to understand that. Don't think of this in terms of ultimate analysis. When is a chair a chair? When is a thing no longer a chair? That's not it. That's not what they're getting at here. When a chair breaks, you cannot sit in it anymore. The fact of impermanence implies issues of ultimate existence. But that is not what is at stake here. It's just that things break, and that is obvious for all to see. That's coarse impermanence. So we see that all the time, don't we? It's harder to see subtle impermanence, though it is said to be going on around us all the time. Subtle impermanence is that change in impermanent phenomena that most Buddhists say happen 360 times every moment. Do you think it doesn't happen 361 times a moment? It is subtle in the sense of being other than gross and obvious, but it is also subtle in the sense of being strong, for it is unstoppable. All right, so with subtle impermanence, to actually know that with an awareness, we need to use reasoning. We need to get at that using inference. Buddhists say that with a stable mind developed in meditation, we can observe subtle impermanence directly. Until then, we can easily envision it. The traditional Indian example for subtle impermanence is a line of candles that all seem to be lighted at the same time, though they are not. The example goes like this. Imagine a line of candles in front of you or all around you. Imagine that the first one is on the left, slowly flames up on its own without being lighted. Then the next one to the right slowly flames up and the first one on the left begins to diminish proportionately. Then after the second candle reaches its peak flame for a moment, the third one, the second to the right of the first one, begins to flame up proportionately as the second one diminishes. Then the fourth one, then the fifth one, and so on for the whole line until it comes back around to the first one, which lights up again, stays a moment, and then diminishes away. Now imagine that once you see the pattern, this magical flaming up and extinguishing away, the sequence starts moving faster and faster until eventually it seems that all the candles are always lighted. Given our tremendous experience in viewing videos, this is easy for us to see. Does that analogy make sense to you? Is that a typical Indian analogy? Maybe just in certain philosophical circles. All right, so let me just add one more thing. In the book that Venerable edited for Geshe Jampa Tekcho, he uses the example of 1 o'clock. Do you remember that? He says, like in the hour preceding 1 o'clock, there are 59 minutes leading up to 1 o'clock. But when you get up to 1 o'clock, where actually is 1 o'clock? 1 o'clock changes, right? It's like it's almost like a continuum between 12:59 and 59 seconds, and then 1 o'clock, and then immediately it's 1 o'clock and 01 second, right? Mm-hmm. So in our mind, we try to make things more static, more solid, more permanent, and that's how they appear to our mind because of our grasping at permanence. But in actuality, there is nothing from an ultimate point of view. Well, is that ultimate? Anyway, you can't point to anything that actually is 1 o'clock that is abiding. It's because the clock is constantly moving.
Another example I've heard is like if you have a burning ball on the end of a rope and you swing it around in a circle, and it looks like it's a ring of fire. And like they do this at circuses and things like that. So it looks like there's a ring of fire, but it's actually just, you know, that one flaming ball moving really quickly.
Yeah, that's typically given as an example of a wrong consciousness, a non-conceptual mm-hmm. wrong consciousness. But I think actually this is trying to get at something a little bit different, which is that in every moment, every impermanent thing is arising and disintegrating. And it gives rise to the next moment of arising and disintegrating. So I think it's a little bit different.
Maybe just the appearance then, that it's a...
Yeah. Yes, object. Okay. Yeah, we can think of it that way. So if you're swinging a ball of light around, usually if you think about a sparkler or even a piece of incense in the dark and you're going around, it looks like there's an actual full circle of light. But it's a moment of light, a moment of light, a moment of light, a moment of light, and it's constantly changing. As well as physically changing, mm-hmm. even if we held the incense in still, it would be changing moment to moment.
Right. Yeah, and it sounds like you're talking things are impermanent at the conventional level because you were getting at there's nothing that abides as itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, arising, abiding, and disintegrating all happen at the same time, at least in the Sutra school and above.
So it's like this microphone. Is a successive moments of different microphones. So it's never a microphone, like one entity.
There's a continuum of microphone.
Yeah,
but we talk about it or we think about it as if it's something very solid and static.
Yeah, conventionally?
Yeah.
Okay.
But you said that, so the Sutra school has the idea that rising, abiding, and ceasing are happening at the same moment. So I've heard Venerable say that a moment is whatever you define it to be.
Yes, I've heard that too.
Yeah, so in here where they talk about 60 or 360, that implies that something arises, and then a separate moment, 360.1, it abides, 360.2, it ceases to me. Like, rather than that you just... chosen to break that moment into 360 just theoretically, but actually there's no moment that you could point to or anything.
Right, it's just a flow of continuum.
Right. So then why would they say that, if they didn't believe in abiding happening at a different moment than arising. That's, I find that kind of, that's why it confused me. I didn't have time to look it up to see which school was saying what, you know, because there are schools that believe that something arises and it abides and it ceases, and those are not happening in the same moment.
Right. There would be consequences to holding that point of view. What is it? Yeah, you'd have to actually be able to find something.
Yeah.
I mean, in general, we can say, like for instance, this house appears to be abiding. We can say in general, it came into being, it abides for, I don't know, 100 years, 200 years, and then eventually, like the house down the hill, it will fall apart. In each moment, what would be the fault? I know I've read it, and I can't call it up right now, so we'll have to...
But my question more goes back to the thing of why do they state like the 60 or 360? That kind of implies to me that there's a moment that it doesn't, that it just abides without coming into being and disintegrating happening at the same moment.
Well, the context that I've heard it in is that...
It's more sense to me to say a moment is whatever you define it to be. Conversation.
Okay, I think the context that they're talking about here is that they say that in the time that we can snap our fingers, we've had 360 mind moments.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an idea, it's a ballpark of how fast our mind is working. And I think that's helpful for us to realize.
It's like an extended illustration.
Yeah.
Like a metaphor. It's not really what's happening.
Well, in a sense,
360 moments.
Well, think about it like a clock. You know, like the moment is, for instance, like the hour. There are 60 minutes in the hour. If we that's a good metaphor, isn't it? There are individual moments within that hour. They're individual minutes, and even those minutes can be broken down. So even those 360 mind moments could be broken down if we had an instrument that could measure it. Or even conceptually, we can think about those. We can break down each of those 360 mind moments into smaller moments. But I think the point that how I've heard it explained, or the context, is our mind is working that fast.
Okay, that's all
of them. Yeah. I think we have a little bit of an advantage growing up. I know many of you probably have never seen an old real movie. You know, the... Yeah. Yes, with individual frames. Now everything is digital and it's completely different. But if you can think about one of those old frames, you have individual frames and they are moving so fast...
Mm-hmm.
That it seems like there's constant movement. But if you slow it down enough, and this is, I think, the point, if you slow it down enough, you can see individual mind moments. And in fact, I remember talking with a woman in Dharamsala who was seriously attempting to develop calm abiding. And she told me that in her best meditations, and she wasn't bragging, we were having a serious conversation, but she said she can feel when a thought's about to arise. You know, that's how still her mind got at some point. But you know, ordinarily, it just happens. You know, we've had so many mind moments. I think it's just to give an illustration of how quick the mind is. I've also heard moments like even an eon can be a moment. It is a very relative term. Okay, anything else? All right. Sometimes on television, you see the following sort of thing. Oh, this didn't make any sense to me. Sometimes on television, you see the following sort of thing. I'm not fully sure of the technical issues involved here, but you know how sometimes you will see a reporter on television will walk into a room where people are looking at computers, and the computers seem to be on the fritz because there is a slow wipe from top to bottom. Does that make sense to anybody? Okay. Okay, good. I can't really call it up. It never seems to bother anybody in the room, and this is because they do not see it. I think it happens only when the monitor uses a cathode ray tube. soon no one will understand this example unless they're looking at old videos, because CRT monitors have been replaced by other types, such as liquid crystal display monitors. The wipe on the screen shows because the monitor is refreshing at a slower rate than the video camera recording what we see. So it catches the impermanence that we would not see if we were in the room looking at the monitor. Maybe another example that would be more familiar to us is when something has been videoed in low resolution. You know, you can almost see it jumping. Does that make sense? I don't know. However you get it, the example is clear enough. The Buddhists are saying that all these impermanent, unstable things around us are arising and abiding only for a moment, but that the refresh rate is so fast that we do not see it, at least not without stable and insightful awareness developed in meditation. The Buddhist example pays homage to the Buddha's fire sermon, in which he describes the world as being on fire. The fire is impermanence. The example clearly suggests that our perception of the world is as stable is an illusion. So, examples of impermanent phenomena. In traditional Buddhist debate, the stock example of an impermanent phenomena is a pot, a bumpa. However, it is clear from the use of the word in Tibetan that what must be appearing to the mind of a Tibetan monk or nun in debate is something more like what we would call a metal vase, the sort of thing used in their initiation ceremonies. The word bumpa does not apply to ordinary pots like the kind we cook with, but experience seems to show that the metal vase is more on point. Flat bottom, round-bellied water holder with a spout. Other frequently used stock examples of impermanent phenomena include sound, a pillar, and some categories themselves, especially functioning thing itself. Okay, so you might remember, I think this has been covered, when a category only includes impermanent instances, the category is considered impermanent. When a category includes only permanent instances, like permanent phenomena, then the category is considered permanent. And when there's a mixture of impermanent and permanent phenomena, like with selfless, then the whole category is considered permanent. In fact, that comes up a little bit later. Among Americans debating in English, we prefer examples such as chair, table, and a rock. Beyond these, there is no constraint. Practically anything can be appropriate, so long as it is momentary phenomena. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. We interact with impermanent phenomena all day long. So that, any questions about that? Any doubts?
When you say selfless,
mm-hmm.
like selfless service, something you
When you say selfless, what do you mean?
Selfless means without a self. And really what it's talking about is without a particular type of self. A self that would be independent, autonomous, existing. There are different ways of talking about that self. But so it lacks an inherent, unchanging self. There is, if we really look for, could we find within our body and mind, like I said, we don't use the word soul, but if we look within our body and mind, the body is constantly changing, the mind is constantly changing, where would we find a permanent soul or a permanent Atman or a permanent self? When we look in the mirror, it seems as if, well, there I am. You know, it's like there's a real self there. But when we investigate further, and we can say, yes, I saw myself in the mirror. I saw a reflection of myself in the mirror. But when we investigate to see, does that self exist the way it appears to me, either through the reflection in the mirror or even the way we think of ourselves, like in moments of really strong emotions, the sense of self gets really big and solid. But that's a really great opportunity to look inside and say, okay, how does it appear to exist right now? Where can I feel it in my body and mind? You know, is it bigger than the body and the mind? Is it smaller? Is it consumed within the body and mind? How does it appear? And then really investigate, could it exist the way it appears? And there's lots of consequences to holding to that kind of self in the Buddhist tradition. So that's one very big distinction between, the say, for instance, Hinduism and Buddhism. lots of similarities, you know, in terms of service. Now, selfless service, that's something else. That's seeing others as more important than oneself or equally important as oneself. That's a different kind of selfless. We have to understand the context of the use of that term. Or, you know, there is a self that exists. There's a temporary or conventional self that exists. But the self that doesn't exist is one that is inherent, independent of anything else, independent of any causes and conditions. Because our body has causes and conditions and parts. Our mind has causes and conditions and parts. That's how it's understood in this tradition. We'll have some more conversations about that. Okay. All right, let's try to finish permanent phenomena if we can. There aren't too many definitions here, just a lot of words. Okay, other than impermanent phenomena, the remaining existence are permanent phenomena. As explained below in the seventh and final division of existence, every existent is a hidden phenomena, which means that each and every existent may be understood by thought consciousness. So that's what we were talking about earlier. Whereas any impermanent phenomena, like a chair or a table, might possibly be understood by thought, every permanent phenomena can only be understood by thought for this sutra school following reasoning. Oh, that is according to the assertions of this particular Buddhist tenet system, the sutra school following reasoning. Permanent phenomena exist and may be known, but they cannot be approached explicitly by anything other than a conceptual consciousness. That's really all it's getting at there. These different phenomena are known by different types of consciousness. The thought or conceptual consciousness that knows a permanent phenomena is itself impermanent, changing all the time as you have observed. But the object observed by that thought is permanent. Often people think that if permanent phenomena can be known only by a thought consciousness, then permanent phenomena do not really exist, that they are just imaginary. However, this is not what the Buddhists believe. In this system, they say that permanent phenomena are real and existent. Real, with, you know, quotation marks. Real and existent. But they are abstract and objects of conceptuality only. For instance, take this simple example of non-cow. Here it comes, non-cow. Non-cow includes everything other than that which is a cow. We saw this when we did some of the comparisons earlier in the book. So a horse is a non-cow, a chair is a non-cow. Established base itself, which is permanent. Oh, wait, yeah, it's permanent. A permanent category itself is non-cow. Everything other than cow itself, where cow includes every individual cow, as well as the plurality of cows, understood as the abstract singular cow, is non-cow. Do you need to see that, or is that clear to your mind? Does an image appear in your mind of what is non-cow? What is included in non-cow?
Anything that's
non-cow. Right.
Okay, we have the selfless, and then we have existence. And non-existence, have to abbreviate. Okay, and then among existence, we have permanent phenomena. But we started with impermanent phenomena, so let's follow them. And we have permanent phenomena. Now, some of you have done a little bit of study before, so you know that impermanent phenomena has three divisions, right? Mm-hmm. Matter. What are the other ones?
Consciousness.
And
abstract composites.
Abstract composites. Which is anything that's impermanent that doesn't, it's not just matter or just consciousness. Okay. Where does cow fit?
Abstract consciousness.
So we have cows here, we have people.
Cows aren't persons? So that, cows are persons, that's why they're there?
Yes.
We have humans. We have cats. Plus many other things that are abstract composites, right? So if we're looking to see what is non-cow, everything except that is non-cow. So humans, cats, consciousness, matter, impermanent phenomena, even permanent phenomena, even non-existence are included in non-cow. It's a very big category, like you said.
Which makes it permanent and existent, because it includes permanent phenomena and existent phenomena. I think that's coming up. Okay. Non-cow includes everything other than that which is cow. So a horse is a non-cow, chair is a non-cow, established base is a non-cow. Everything other than cow itself, where cow includes every... Okay, I read that. In the collected topic system of Buddhist reasoning and debate, non-cow is a permanent phenomena because it includes everything other than cow. Think about it. And you will see that this is a real abstraction, something you could get only intellectually, conceptually, by thinking about it. Clearly, it does not mean that each and every non-cow is a permanent phenomena. Even though non-cow, the category, is permanent, not everything included, not every instance of that category is permanent. For a chair is a non-cow, but it is an impermanent, breakable thing, whereas non-cow itself is permanent. So non-cow is not an imaginary thing. It is easy to see that it is real, for you are surrounded by manifest examples of non-cow. Indeed, you can see a chair that is not a cow, observe it directly, but what are they saying in this system? What they are saying in this system is that you cannot observe directly that chair's absence of being a cow. Chair's absence of being a cow. You can't see that with your sense consciousness. You can only get through at that by a conceptual consciousness. It is a quality of the chair you are sitting in, or the cushion you're sitting on, in that it is a non-cow, but it is a static, unchanging quality that was not built into the chair. Please reflect on this. This will keep you up tonight. Non-cow.
To me, the reason is not that the thing with that all these instances of non-cows are include permanent and impermanent phenomena. You know, you were saying that everything that's non-cow includes things that are both permanent and impermanent. And so, as a group, that would be considered permanent. But I don't think that's what it's saying here. I think it's saying that, like, this last part here, I think, is what it is. It is this unchanging quality that's not built into the chair.
Right, and that we, like, there is a quality of non-cow in this thermos. We can't see that with our sense consciousness.
Right.
It's an abstract.
Right.
However, the thermos, which is non-cow, is impermanent, and we can touch it, we can drink from it, we can see it.
So it has to do with that quality of being non-cow isn't changing moment by moment. I think that's why it's permanent.
Yeah. Yeah, non-cow pervades everything that is not a cow. And that is not changing moment to moment. Even though the thing that has that characteristic, it's just like emptiness. The emptiness of this thermos, right, the emptiness of this thermos is permanent, and yet the thermos is changing moment to moment. Yeah, it's like that. Thank you.
Non-cowness is not changing. Its quality of being non-cow.
Just like the emptiness is not changing moment to moment, the quality of non-cow is not changing moment to moment. There is a quality of non-cow for each moment, you know, 360 per moment, moments per moment. All right. Recall from the comments above in regard to the selfless that one of the guidelines of Buddhist ontology is that a group that includes both permanent and impermanent phenomena is itself a permanent phenomena. Non-cow is such a group. The reason such a group is considered to be permanent is because it is an intellectual abstraction, an object of thought only, though still existent. This guideline is reminiscent of the guideline that a group that includes both existence and non-existence is itself existent. This too came up in regard to the selfless itself. Like the selfless, non-cow too includes non-existence that are not cows. Still, non-cow is existent because it includes both existence and non-existence, therefore it's existent. These guidelines are reckoned in relation to the consciousness that can perceive the groups. Again, please reflect on this.
Is non-cow a hidden phenomenon?
Yes. Because every phenomenon is a hidden phenomenon. But it's particularly a hidden phenomenon because it's permanent and only known through thought consciousness. Yes.
So this is where I'm confused here in this. So how about when I talk about the generality of chairs, which by the definition is an impermanent phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
But am I not just getting at that through thought? See, it doesn't make much sense to me when they say something like this,
right,
that you can then say that if you have a group of things and they're all impermanent, then the generality of that is also impermanent. When you're getting at it through a thought, and here they're saying it's because of the thought that
uh-huh.
it's permanent.
So, okay, yeah. There are always exceptions to every rule, aren't there? Yeah. Yeah. How I've heard this explained before is that this thing about something being permanent or impermanent, depending on what's included in the category, mm-hmm. is a convention. Now, there are other explanations, a more thorough explanation in debate that I haven't read it enough times that it has stuck in my mind. Mm-hmm. But if we think about it, it's just a convention for debate. Mm-hmm. Then it makes sense. Yeah.
So when you think of chairs and you just think of them with your eyes closed through a meaning generality, as I was called, then what appears to the mind is meaning generality. But what is apprehended by the mind is an impermanent phenomenon of
chairs. No, what appears to the mind is a meaning generality of chairs.
Yeah.
Not just a meaning generality, but a meaning generality of chairs. And what the mind understands or apprehends or engages is chairs.
Right.
Yeah.
And so then with non-cow, what appears to the mind is a generality of non-cow.
Mm-hmm.
And what the mind apprehends is also an abstract. It's not when you're... That's why an impermanent phenomena can be both manifest and can fall in either of those groups, because when you're apprehending, what you apprehend is actually a chair.
Yes. What you understand, what you apprehend.
And you're understanding uh-huh. an impermanent phenomena.
Yes.
Here you're
That's
understanding
right.
something that can never be perceived with your senses, and that even as the apprehended object.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why it has to be permanent. Because
uh-huh.
it's abstract in both ways, the appearing and the apprehended object.
I'm not sure you'd say that the appearing object was abstract. Why are you, I don't understand why you're, did you have something to say?
Basically, isn't he saying that with a non-cow, there's only a conceived object? There's no engaged object.
Well, engaged object pervades conceived object. Yeah.
Right, so there's no appearing... What is it that there's none of... There's only the conceived object, right, for a non-cow?
No, it's conceived object, so you don't have those for direct perception.
Right. Conceived object is the engaged object for a conception.
Right.
Yeah.
It's both the engaged and appearing object.
No.
No,
no, the appearing object is necessarily a generic image of non-cow. The appearing object, this is something very specific to sutra school, and I'm sure we'll go over it a lot. You know, and this is what they call mistaken consciousnesses. So anytime there's a thought consciousness, the appearing object is a generic image of whatever it's getting at.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm saying, so you say there's nothing that can be directly perceived.
Well, it's true.
No.
Non-cow.
That
oh, that's right. That's right. Everything is non-cow. What do you say? Please reflect on this.
Yeah, but the quality of being non-cow is abstract.
Yeah. The quality of being non-cow is abstract, but the thing that has that quality is not abstract and can be known by direct perception. Yeah. Okay. All right. Can we push on?
So yes. Then what happens with the calf? Right? As in, at some point it becomes cow, right? As in, its non-cowness is not static.
Yeah, good point. When is a calf a cow?
The consequence.
Okay. Yeah, Buddhist joke. Okay. How are you doing? Are you fading, or can we do a little more?
Yeah.
All right. I'm translating the Sanskrit Nitya and the Tibetan Thakpa as permanent phenomena, singular, and permanent phenomena, plural. This is so confusing. We were talking about this today, that some of these words are quite ambiguous because Tibetan is a contextual language I just learned today. Okay, these are translations I used in debate in Tibetan Buddhism, and these are the predominant and perhaps exclusive translations for these terms in South Asian epistemology. However, there is an important problem with permanent, or at least there is an unusual understanding of that permanent means here, of what permanent means here. This unusual understanding must be writ large, what does that mean? Is that slang or something? And underscored so that the reader will always bear this in mind. Unless you have been schooled in Indian thought, you can correct us if we're wrong, you will naturally think that permanent means eternal. Okay, we've heard that term enough that we understand that's not what's being gotten at here. It might be that you allow for the possibility that some eternal phenomena were not brought into being at the dawn of time, or you might deny that and think that all eternal things not only have no end, but also had no beginning. Either way, eternal would imply that there is no end to such a phenomena. However, this is not the meaning of permanent phenomena, as spoken of in Indian philosophy. Here, permanent does not necessarily mean eternal. Okay, just repeat that to yourself many times. Okay, and what we'll see in this next section is that there are two different, or down below the divisions, there are two different types of permanent phenomena. So we'll come to that. All right, so rather, a permanent phenomena is defined as a common locus of a phenomena, has to exist, right? And the moment, non-momentary. Okay, so phenomena excludes what? Non-existence. And non-momentary excludes? Momentary, impermanent. Okay. A common locus is an existent that is a basis or locus of two or more qualities, and everything that exists is a common locus. For instance, the United States of America is a common locus of a nation state and a member of the United Nations. You are a common locus of a human and a person. Did you know those two things are different? I am a common locus of a man and a human. Well, I am a common locus of a woman and a human. On and on infinitely. At the very least, you can see that everything that exists is a common locus of an established base and that which is suitable as an object of an awareness. So that's definition of object of knowledge, isn't it? The definition of a permanent phenomena specifies that it is a basis or locus of a phenomena, meaning that it must be an existent and that it is something that is non-momentary. Recall that impermanent phenomena are always momentary, for that is how they are defined. Permanent phenomena are existents that are non-momentary. Momentary means that the thing is changing moment to moment. A permanent phenomena never changes. Okay, we'll have to qualify that, but a permanent phenomena never changes. Now, if it exists and it never changes, one might naturally think that it would be eternal. However, the thought in Buddhist ontology has it that a permanent phenomena is unchanging for the duration of its existence. Maybe underline that. though it may not exist forever. Okay, so here it is spelled out for us in the division on permanent phenomena. Permanent phenomena may be divided into two groups, those that are stable in time, or abiding permanence, and those that exist for an occasion, occasional permanence. A permanent phenomena that is stable in time or abiding permanent phenomena is one that is eternal. Okay, so there is how many possibilities between permanent phenomena and eternal? Eternal phenomena, I think we'd have to say. Three possibilities. Very good. Okay. Because there is something that is permanent phenomena that is not eternal or not stable in time, and that's occasional permanence. This includes such thing. Okay, so we're talking now about permanent phenomena that is stable in time or abiding permanent phenomena. This includes such things as the selfless, established base, and so on. There can be no time when there is nothing that is selfless, for that would mean that there would have to be a self. Remember that utter non-existence, too, would be selfless. In the same way, there can be no time when there is no established base, for that would mean that nothing at all exists. So there we have the two extremes. All right. Then a permanent phenomena that exists for an occasion is one that is reckoned in relation to a non-eternal phenomena. For instance, one of the stock examples of a permanent phenomena is uncompounded space, which is identified as the absence of obstructive contact. Uncomposed space is not the same as created space. Ah, I like it. Like when you step back from someone who is standing too close, or when a bottle maker provides a liter of space inside a bottle. Rather, uncomposed space is an abstract absence, a lack of obstructive contact. Space is all-pervading because there is an absence of obstructive contact everywhere, even where solid objects exist. This is a difficult concept for Westerners, but I think probably most of us have heard it enough times that it's starting to sink in. Space is all-pervading, uncompounded space in particular, is all-pervading because there is an absence of obstructive contact. That's the definition of uncompounded space. There's that lack everywhere, that absence everywhere, even where solid objects exist. For without an absence of obstructive contact, an obstructive object could not be there in the first place. So uncomposed space itself is an abiding and stable permanent phenomena. However, the uncomposed space reckoned in relation to a non-eternal phenomena, such as the inside of a bottle, is a non-eternal permanent phenomena that exists for an occasion. Might have to read that a few times. For the duration of the life of the bottle, that uncomposed space within it is stable and unchanging. Once the bottle is destroyed, it is no longer suitable to speak of the space inside the bottle. We can remember it, and our recollection that the bottle had space inside of it is clear. But the bottle is no longer a bottle, and so the uncomposed space inside of it went out of existence. So it was merely labeled uncomposed space inside the bottle. Okay, it's like we cordoned off that uncomposed space while there was an object that could contain it. But once that container goes, then you no longer have the uncomposed space within the bottle. Okay, both of these types of permanent phenomena, abiding permanent phenomena and permanent phenomena that exist for an occasion, are stable and unchanging for the time that they exist, but only abiding permanent phenomena are eternal. Always bear this understanding in mind when thinking of permanence in this system. Permanence here does not necessarily mean eternal.
It follows that there are not three possibilities between permanent and eternal phenomena. Right? Did we posit that just now?
Permanent and eternal.
Did we say that there are three possibilities?
Eternal phenomena.
Yeah, eternal
okay,
phenomena.
Okay, let's
because
have a
they are impermanent eternal phenomena. We should do that. Yeah, Venerable went through this with us in the low rig, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so right. We should have a look.
Okay, so we're going to compare. What was it? Permanent and eternal phenomena. Permanent and eternal phenomena. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, is there something that's both a permanent phenomena and eternal phenomena?
Uncomposed space.
Uncomposed space. Or uncomposed space is the term he's using. All right. Is there something that is permanent phenomena, but not eternal?
Uncomposed space inside of a bottle.
The space inside a bottle.
That's the example he just gave.
Right.
Space.
Is there something that is eternal phenomena that is not permanent phenomena? Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yes.
Continuums are permanent, are impermanent.
Impermanent
eternal.
It's a changing moment by moment.
It's a
What's the definition of eternal? Never ending?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a mind stream considered.
It's from the notes as well, actually.
Yeah.
Really
it's good to have it. Okay, thanks for that correction.
And then
a chair. Oh yeah.
Cow. Couldn't say non-cow. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Yeah, that's good to think about.
Okay, any last comments or questions? Yes.
When I think about gross impermanence, something just going out of existence, it almost seems like things that have occasional permanence have gross impermanence, because they're not momentary, but they go out of existence.
Well,
I know it's not phrased that way, but
no. Like, for instance, the emptiness of the thermos exists as long as the thermos exists. So when it goes out of when the thermos goes out of existence, what are you saying about the emptiness of the thermos?
It no longer exists, so it changed from it being existent to
but it wasn't a momentary change.
No, so
and
it's
that's
not
the definition.
Yeah, but so it's not. So that's that definition.
Non-momentary means momentary is only understood as changing moment to moment in a subtle way. That's why we had that.
Right. So what is gross impermanence? Gross impermanence is not really under that definition. Gross impermanence is like when the house falls down because it changed moment by moment by moment for a long time, and then boosh.
Right.
Or it got hit by a plane.
It's an accumulation of subtle impermanence, of subtle changes, isn't it?
Yeah. Unless you light the stove and it's been leaking gas all night and it blows up. But yeah, like something disintegrates. Mostly gross impermanence is a result of long-term subtle impermanence.
Mostly? Or pervasively?
It's maybe not pervasively, because your example is the one where it's not.
The Twin Towers didn't crumble on their own.
But they were already crumbling.
They were, but that wasn't the result of them of that crumbling where they would have stood longer. It was the result of another.
But even talking about breaking, the chair breaking, it doesn't have to be subtle impermanence of, you know, disintegration, natural disintegration.
Right, to be
something that's broken or something that's bombed or.
Yeah, so.
Repeat your point.
Yeah.
I started from saying it seems like things that have occasional impermanence.
Occasional permanence.
Seem to be subject to gross impermanence, though not subtle impermanence. They're not momentary, but they change. They go from being existent to a non-existent.
Yes, but in the definition of permanent, which is the common locus of a phenomena, and non-momentary, that's only talking about subtle impermanence.
Right, so it doesn't
momentary
conflict with gross impermanence, which is not momentary.
No, but impermanence and permanence conflict.
Yeah, they're mutually exclusive.
So I wonder if we can find a definition somewhere of gross impermanence.
I looked in, I think if it was going to be there, I'll take another look in debate, but I think it was going to be, it would have been included in Insight into Emptiness, and I didn't see a definition there. It's more like a description. Yeah, but I love the way you think. Yeah, I do. Okay, so let's rejoice that we've had this time together to think about these things like non-cows and occasional permanence and sharpen our minds. I'm sure you feel sharper. Now, seriously, let's rejoice that we are in contact with these teachings and that this is helping us to increase our wisdom. And we're going to combine that with our strong bodhicitta motivation so that we can eventually have a direct, reliable cognizer of emptiness and eliminate all suffering for ourselves and all beings.